Well, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us this afternoon. It's my pleasure to introduce myself. My name is Dave Quist. I'm the Executive Director of the Institute of Marriage and Family, and thank you for joining us today. I'd like to thank Pierre for sponsoring this event and co-sponsored by Dan McTeague, who isn't here yet. He's been at committee, and so I know he's hoping to make it here later this afternoon. So my thanks to both of you for co-sponsoring this most important event. The Institute of Marriage and Family Canada gathers and writes research and papers that we think will be of value to you. And in so doing today, we're working with Alex and the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition that will bring something forward that is important for our society. And so that is why we brought people together like Bobby and Dr. Cottle, that we can talk about these events and we can look a little bit ahead to the future and say, why are we talking about this now? You know, it may not be on the legislative agenda today, but we should think about it and be prepared for it and understand why it is an important issue that we talk about today before it's too late to talk about it. Our publication, which is available at the back someplace, I'm not sure where, but it'll be back there somewhere, is something I just wanted to draw to your attention today as well. In it, you'll find an interview with Dr. Cottle. Her dog, Kaylee, is mentioned in there as well, and go and find out why that's important, actually. And there's also another article in the magazine specific to today's discussion about the history of euthanasia. How did we get here is important that we know that so that we don't repeat those pieces of history without knowing that already. So please pick up a copy of the magazine if you haven't already got one. It's here at the back beside the towards the coffee machine over here. We all know where the coffee machine is. So it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Cottle to you today. She and I have spoken many times over the last number of months. We've emailed back and forth, and today we've actually had an opportunity to meet in person and break bread together and enjoy each other's company a little bit. She describes herself as no shrinking violet, and I think when you see her information and her passion, you'll understand why that is. She is passionate about this topic. She is knowledgeable in this topic. As previously mentioned, she speaks widely on this topic as well, and therefore is somebody that is a good advocate for us, a good resource for us, as we look at the very human side of the story with people like Terry, and then we look at the palliative care side of it and the medical side of it and how we can learn from that as well. I'm looking forward to her comments. I know that you will be as well. We will be having a question and answer time following this as well for anything that is burning in your mind you'd like to figure out and ask either one of our two guest speakers as well. Her talk and Bobby's talk as well will be on our website in the next few days as well as her presentation will be available in the near future as well. So if I could ask you to come forward, please, Dr. Cottle.
All right. Can everybody hear and see? That's great. Thank you so much for coming. It's so nice to actually have people show up when you have something to say. And it's great to do that. I think parliamentarians understand what that feels like a little bit. The other thing that I need to say before I even start is that I have way too much stuff here. I know that. But I feel a little bit like Anne of Green Gables, who said, if you only knew all the things I wanted to say and didn't say them, you'd at least give me credit for that. So part of what I will do is I will probably skim over some things, but I'm going to leave the slides in so that it gives you a place to be thinking about, a little nidus for thought, so that when the presentation goes on to the website, that you'll be thinking about, well, I'm going to go and look at that and see a little bit more about that. So I hope to be able to do that. So one of the topic actually is supposed to be that palliative care is a better alternative. And that's basically what I'm going to speak to you about today. But the underlying theme for me is that life is always a gift. And so that's what I put that as a title. Now, what do you think we Canadians cite as the foundations of our society? And what would form the basis of our cultural ethos? Now, all right, because this is participation. What are the things? What are the iconic things about our culture that we consider important?
Healthcare.
Okay, our universal healthcare system?
Family.
Family, what else?
Freedom.
How about multiculturalism? That's what I've got on my thing. Okay, I think if you ask Canadians across the board. You'll get our healthcare system and how inclusive we are, our multicultural society. Now, what underlies both of these things? I put it to you that there are two things that underlie both of these. One is the concern for the protection of the weak and vulnerable, which could also be called compassion. And the other is a sense of fairness with the more powerful willing to forgo privileges in order to serve others, to serve individuals, and to serve the community as a whole. And that's called altruism. Or you can call it love if you want to, but that gets a little complicated. Altruism is a little more parliamentarian. Okay. The protection of both of these core elements of our national identity, and they are core, compassion and altruism, is a significant consideration in the debate about euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide. So what is our goal? If compassion and altruism are to retain their significance, we need to protect the civil framework that's going to foster these virtues. So what better supports altruism and compassion? Supporting the dying patient and his family in a loving community, offering help and reassurance and comfort, or sending that person into the unknown alone. So you think about it. The concept of mercy killing, and I might even call it an oxymoron, but for this audience we'll call it a concept, is predicated on the assumption that death will bring comfort, peace, or relief to the person. Now, despite those words that sound very clinical and scientific, there is not one shred of peer-reviewed evidence that people are better off dead. Now, and when I teach at the medical school, everything is supposed to be evidence-based, but there is not one shred of evidence that you're better off dead. The major change when somebody dies is that we, the living, no longer have to deal with a sick or a dying loved one. It is said that we put the other person out of our misery. Many have strongly held beliefs that heaven of some sort exists, or the strongly held belief that it does not exist. But these are beliefs, and they're not provable facts. And it's really interesting to me that often people who insist that there's absolutely nothing after this present life still assert that death brings peace. However, this assertion alone is not a defensible solid foundation for this practice, and it only is quicksand. It's no solid rock. What new procedure or medication would be introduced into the practice of medicine with no evidence for benefit and many red flags urging caution? The onus is always on the people proposing the change to show that no harm is going to result. And physicians are conservative for a reason. Remember thalidomide. That was introduced quickly. And, you know, right now there's a huge hullabaloo I heard on the radio the other day because silicone breast implants are being reintroduced, okay? And everybody's saying, oh, the government is supposed to protect us from these horrible devices. Well, what are we thinking about when we're wanting to do something that doesn't have any positives? There's no evidence for the desired outcome and a great deal of evidence underscoring the myriad dangers involved in the practice. So what's at stake? I would say that the very fabric of our society, being founded on altruism and compassion, is at stake here. Even if you have no religious affiliation, the fabric of the society is at stake. Okay, Hippocrates understood this. Hippocrates lived 400 years before Christ, so anybody who tells you that Hippocrates was just flaunting Christian doctrine doesn't know his history. Medical practitioners in Hippocrates' day killed or healed depended on who gave them more money, either the patient or the enemy down the street. And Hippocrates believed that he was going to be answerable to a higher authority after his own death, or a group of higher authorities, and he established a group of practitioners which were set apart by the oath that they took that said that they would only heal, they would not kill. And patients voted with their feet. He started off with a small group of people, went totally against the tide of medicine at the time, and everybody went to them because they were real happy to go where people had pledged they wouldn't kill them. My friend John Patrick has a Hippocratic medicine pin on, and the bank teller asked him what it stood for, and he said, oh, that means I won't kill you. Okay, so here's a little excerpt from the Hippocratic Oath. We'll post this, I think it's actually in the magazine, but it's quite a long oath, and this is the one that the Canadian Registry of Hippocratic Physicians uses, and this is a little excerpt from it. I will follow that method of treatment which, according to my ability and judgment, I consider for the benefit of my patient and abstain from whatever is harmful or mischievous. I will neither prescribe nor administer a lethal dose of medicine to any patient, even if asked, nor counsel any such thing, nor perform act or omission with direct intent deliberately to end a human life. Now, if the physicians had been Hippocratic, who had been taking care of Terry, she would not have died. All right. I will maintain the utmost respect for every human life from fertilization to natural death and reject abortion that deliberately takes a unique human life. Okay? Quite up to date, actually. Okay, so that's if we're sort of doing it on purpose. What if the person wants it? What about autonomy? Whose life is it anyway? First of all, about autonomy. A complete autonomy is a total illusion. We are all connected to one another. There is not one thing that you will do today completely on your own without help from somebody else. We already have many restrictions on our autonomy, from our families where you don't play your tuba at 3 in the morning so everybody else can sleep, to traffic laws, to border security, all kinds of things. We have lots of restrictions on our autonomy that we consider to be completely reasonable for the functioning of civil society. And also, a right to die or to be assisted in dying prescribes duties for others to assist. It's not just my autonomous right that affects no one else. And the other thing about autonomy that's very interesting in the studies that have been done on it, it's much more often a concern of the strong, healthy, and privileged classes of society than it is of those who would be the vulnerable people who are at risk. Now, the foundations of medical ethics, there are 6 basic foundations: respect for persons, informed consent, and autonomy sort of fits in those 2 categories, beneficence, which means doing good, and non-maleficence, which means not doing wrong or harm, proportionality, which means that what you do has to have a proportional benefit for the harm that you're causing, basically, or the difficulties, and justice. But lately in medical ethics, autonomy has been trumping everything. Now, this is radical autonomy, too. It's not just, I should be able to make my own decisions. This is autonomy to the point where what I want to do affects everybody else in a way that I prescribe duties for them. So what are some of the implications of radical autonomy? Well, the first is that the relationship between physician and patient, which used to be a covenantal relationship, and that word was used even in non-religious medical circles, is now a contract. So I say I'll do this, you say you'll do that, which is very different than the bond that's made in a covenantal relationship. And we've replaced paternalism, where trained professionals told untrained patients what to do, with radical autonomy, where untrained patients tell trained doctors what they want. Now, how has that improved the life of people? The other thing it does is, in a way, it releases medical professionals from responsibility. Now they're just following orders. They don't have to decide whether something's right or wrong, kind or cruel. The patient wants it, that's what we do. Hands off. I don't have to think. And there's some more subtle difficulties. What if the moral convictions of the physician and the patient are in conflict? Who wins? We're seeing this in lots of conscience legislation that is needing to come. There are people who are pharmacists and doctors and others who are being told that they have to do things that are not within their own conscience to do them. And we should be asking ourselves as a culture, do we want to have medical practitioners who will do what they're told and not follow their conscience? Do we want medical practitioners where the state can tell them what to do and they say, yes, sir, instead of saying, no, I think that's wrong? Who do you want taking care of you? Also, this is a little more subtle one. Should my present healthy self be able to dictate care for my older, less healthy self? Say right now, in my 50s, relatively healthy, relatively competent, that I decide that if I ever get to the point where I need a feeding tube, where my cognition is impaired, where my mobility is impaired, that I really would rather live and don't ever put a feeding tube in me. Okay, fast forward to my 80s. I now have a frontal lobe stroke, which affects my and other parts too, but the frontal lobe's affected, so I don't see into the future too much. I'm not swallowing very well, so I need to have a feeding tube. My mobility's a little bit down, but you know, I kind of enjoy sitting on my deck watching the birds and having my grandchildren crawl around, and people who know me might say that I'm actually easier to live with than I was when I was a feisty 50-year-old. Okay? So why is it that this person that I am right now, who thinks that I might not like to live like that, can trump the right to life of that person. Now, I think Winston Churchill said that democracy is the worst form of government, except for all the others. And it may be that autonomy is the worst form of making decisions, except for all the others. But I'm saying we do not have enough angst about this. We just say, oh, well, that's what the person wanted. When, you know, if I'm sitting out there on my deck enjoying that, why should I have to die just because I had no concept that it would actually be a decent existence for me? The deep philosophical and moral issue is not about rights. It's about our response to our own suffering and to the suffering of fellow human beings. Way harder to deal with. Rights are important. They're important because infallible safeguards are impossible. You just have to look at the Netherlands and at Oregon to see what's been happening there. Also, limited resources may seem to justify utilitarian ethics. Who decides? I ask you, do you want the same people who brought you Canada Post and the Revenue Canada Agency deciding whether you live or die with no chance of appeal? I mean, think about it. How many letters have you lost? Okay? This is what it is. It's not some nice person sitting there who decides this. It's a bureaucracy that makes these decisions. Also, protection is needed for the weak and vulnerable because rights need to come in where love has failed. We would have no need of rights. We're so proud of rights, but we would have no need of rights if everyone had sacrificial, unconditional love for everyone else. Because if I had that love for you and you had that love for me, we would take care of each other. So rights are an admission that we are a fallen people. We need them. It's much better than having no rights, because that's the human condition. But we need to admit that it's a failure of love, that it's a stopgap measure. It's not the highest end. However, rights are only part of the story. You know those pictures that if you're standing back, it looks like a picture, and when you get up close, every little thing is made up, these little tiny pictures that are other pictures? That's what rights are like. Rights are that little tile, and we need to step back and look at the overarching picture, which includes the altruism and compassion and care for other fellow human beings who are suffering and their families. That's the big picture. That little picture is complete, but it's not everything. So how did we get here? This is where I'm going to really blast through, so hang on to your seats. The competent adult patients in Canada have had the right to refuse treatment since 1935. In 1974, the criminal code was amended so that suicide was no longer a criminal offense, but aiding or counseling suicide still was. And the reason the law was changed was because we didn't want it a criminal offense to attempt suicide so that people wouldn't seek help. That was the idea. It wasn't that, oh, we now think suicide is a great idea, we're going to decriminalize it. It was to allow people to seek help. In 82, and it took until 85 before all of it was implemented, the Charter of Rights came to be. And during the past 20 years, what's happened is we have switched from the general focus has turned from the common good and community rights to the rights of individuals. Now, I'm going to talk about two cases from the United States because they predate some of the things that happened here. And if we think we live in a vacuum, we're crazy. All of the things that happen in a global, especially in a North American context. And these ones are actually quite good to see. The first one was in 1975 in New Jersey with Karen Ann Quinlan. She collapses at a party. She's diagnosed as being in a persistent vegetative state, a term I don't like, but that's what is used in the literature, so I'm going to use it. And her condition doesn't improve over a number of months. Her parents go to court and eventually earn the right to turn off her ventilator. Okay? Not her feeding tube, her ventilator. They turn off the ventilator. She continues to breathe on her own. She lives 10 years in a nursing home, being fed through a tube, and dies of pneumonia. Okay? In 1983, Nancy Cruzan loses control of her car. She ends up in a water-filled ditch, face down, and she's without oxygen for at least 15 minutes, and she's diagnosed in a persistent vegetative state. Now, her parents fight to stop feeding her, and they take that fight all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. They lose right there because they couldn't prove that Nancy wanted to die, and they go back and they find some circumstantial evidence. They take it back to the Missouri courts, and the Missouri court says, fine, they remove her feeding tube, and she dies, and there's a big push for living wills so that you can tell people about this after her case. Now, this is interesting because this is what's written on her tomb, on her grave marker. Nancy Beth Cruzan, born July 20th, 1957, departed January 11th, 1983, at peace December 26, 1990. And here's, I'm going to, two quotations from around that time. This fellow, Mr. Momeyer, said, Nancy Cruzan died in January 11th, 1983, when she was but 25 years old. Unfortunately for her, for those who loved her, and indeed for all of us, she died at a time and in a place that does not recognize her death. Consequently, she has never been buried or cremated, but instead kept in a hospital bed for nearly 7 years. High medical technology has sustained only the most rudimentary of her biological processes. Now, do you see what this person is saying? That she died when she had the accident, okay? Not when she, when her bodily function ceased. The court had to weigh this quote-unquote right to die with her life. And here's the judge's opinion. And he said, Nancy is not dead, nor is she terminally ill. This is a case in which we are asked to allow the medical profession to make Nancy die by starvation and dehydration. The debate here is thus not between life and death. It is between quality of life and death. So I think this case really does a good job of setting out the parameters of what we're talking about. And it gets to the heart of the definition of life itself. So is it ever acceptable to say that someone is a living human being, but not a person, not entitled to the legal protection granted to all our citizens? And what are the implications of that? Well, even our own Canadian history is full of things like this. For example, women were not considered persons until the Persons Act, or the Women's Franchise Act of 1918. It's called the Persons Act. We celebrate it. We celebrate it every year. And they, you had to be 21 and you had to be a British subject that could have voted in a provincial election. But even with that, it excluded Asians until 1948, the Inuit until 1950, who were here before us, for heaven's sakes, and the same with status Indians until 1960. Okay, now to come into Canada. Nancy B. was a 25-year-old woman from Quebec. She had a severe, rare neurological disorder. She was fully competent and decided that she would like to have her life-sustaining respirator discontinued. The judge visited her in her hospital bed and decided that she was making a decision for herself and decided that she would, and she was competent to make it and she wasn't depressed or other things like that. And so she was allowed to have her respirator turned off at that time and given sedatives to help ease her symptoms. Around the same time, Sue Rodriguez came onto the scene with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. And in 1992, she presented a video evidence to Parliament because she couldn't come. And she said these two questions, who owns my life and whose body is this? And other people have put it, or whose life is it anyway? That's her question. So this is an autonomy question, all right? And actually, Terry's case is really an autonomy question too, because if her family had not stuck up for her, then there would not have been any question about whether or not that would have happened. It just would have been a matter of course. Okay. The Supreme Court of Canada, she took it to the Supreme Court saying, if I want to kill myself to the point when I'm so disabled that I can't do it, you should make somebody do it for me because it's a human right because I'm disabled. I shouldn't have to do it sooner because I'm going to be too disabled to do it myself. So the Supreme Court decided against her, but only 5-4, which is quite interesting. And it was split right down the lines of the five saying, no, society has compelling interests in keeping these practices illegal, and the other four saying her autonomy rights are being denied. Okay. And they did also note that there's a fine line between seeking to care and seeking death. Whoops. And Margaret Somerville commenting on this, and if you haven't read any of her stuff, I just commend her to you. She's great on this issue. It is sometimes a difficult line to draw, but just because we've got difficult lines doesn't mean they're not present and doesn't mean they're not important. Okay. So she died in 94 in February, which was reported as a physician-assisted suicide, but no physician has ever come forward to confirm it. I didn't hear that. October 93, Robert Latimer kills his disabled daughter Tracy by carbon monoxide poisoning on his farm in Saskatchewan. Okay? He says later he has never felt that this was the wrong thing to do. No matter how many people came forward to offer help and support, he was not interested. He said, "We've always known we've done what was best for her, regardless of what or who says differently." That's what he said. And he's tried twice. He's eventually convicted of second-degree murder. And there's this huge outcry for clemency, but he's currently serving a sentence which includes 10 years without chance for parole. Now, disabled advocates will say, they say, would there have been such an outcry in the community for clemency for Robert Latimer if we had read the headline, "Robert Latimer Kills Genius Daughter"? Now, what does that say about us? Go back to our first things. What does it say about us as a culture when we cry out for clemency for a father who kills a disabled child and not for someone who would kill an able-bodied or mentally normal child? And to set the record straight, she was not doing all that much suffering. It said on the Friday before he killed her that she had a good day at school in her school records. And the other thing was that the family had been offered all kinds of additional assistance, which they had declined. Okay. David can tell us more about that. I'm sure you know more about those things.